Hello and welcome to the Keeper Cup Podcast. Chad Young and Pete Ball both with you here as we are now Sunday, March 10th. You'll be hearing this a day or two later, but we're getting down to, we're like 9 days away from real baseball, huh? Because there's that Soul Series coming up soon. And then another 9 days away from real baseball again.
I mean, I don't know about you, Chad. I know you run Ought New Leagues, but how much of a commission you are outside of Ought New, but the Soul Series is really like kind of messed with drafts and stuff where like I don't mind drafting after the Soul Series, but you know, if like Chris Taylor hits two home runs, then he's going to go like 80 picks ahead of ADP. And it's just, it's, I don't know. It's cool that baseball's spreading. I just, why couldn't we play in Soul a week later? I guess. I don't know. Being crabby. I mean, I assume, no reason.
Yeah. It's gotta be a travel thing, right? They don't want the players to have to like travel to and from Soul in the middle of everything else going on. I find it like, I don't know, most of my drafts, everybody wanted to be drafting before then anyways, so that's fine. So I'm going to be done with all of my drafts. Some of them are happening Tuesday, like hours before those games, but we will be done with drafts before those games happen. The bigger issue I have is in my head-to-head leagues, because in season-long leagues, whatever, you count that, like you just play those games and fine.
Yep.
In head-to-head leagues, like, do you count those as part of the first matchup? Like, how does that even work? I think most of my head-to-head leagues are just ignoring it, but I'm not actually sure.
Yeah, on ESPN, I better figure that out. It's going to bake it into the first week. So those hot performances, if you draft after, will totally count towards that first week, in ESPN at least.
They'll retroactively count?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's terrible because, like, if you're in a head-to-head league...
And here's my problem, yeah.
Yeah, if you're in a head-to-head league that's doing that, like, and some reliever comes on and gets a unexpected win or save or throws three good innings or something like that, like, draft that guy and then cut him a day later. Yep. But, like, man, that's, like... Like, what are they going to do if, for example, you draft... I don't know. I'm gonna use a bad example here, but let's say you drafted Manny Machado, since he's playing in those games, and then cut him like an hour after the draft. Do his stats from that do they count? What are they gonna do with that? Because
only if he was drafted into your starting lineup. If you draft him onto your bench, then it won't count it.
That is just bizarre.
If we could count all the things wrong with ESPN Fantasy Baseball, this podcast would be a lot longer than an hour.
Well, we're going to try to keep it to an hour today, and this is episode 128, so we got to talk jerseys, and then we'll tell you a little bit about what we're going to do. Jersey number 28 is it's a surprisingly uninteresting jersey number. So, Burt Blylevin wore it for 19 years, 94.5 career F4, or B-war, R-war, war. We're looking at reference war, baseball reference. So 94.5. Then there's a bunch of guys who wore the number for like 1 to 4 years. But the next guy who wore it for 5+ years is Nolan Arenado at 11 years. And he has like literally 40 less war than Blylevin. He's at 54.1. And then the third guy on this list is Veda Pinzón, and then Cesar Cedeño. It's not the most inspiring jersey number we've been through.
Somebody needs to go out.
I'm fine with that. I think somebody needs to go out and wear the number 28 and like make it their own, because there is an opportunity here to own that number. So, you know,
there's some fun.
Everyone, any AAA player listening to us, this is it. This is your chance.
Yeah, this is your number,
take
man.
Take 28. Yeah. So for episode 128, we're going to do, you know, a lot of podcasts do the like take it or leave it, buy or sell kind of thing. We, of course, we will call it keep or cut, but we're going to look at spring training performances, and we're going to do a little keep or cut on spring training performances. And I will start by saying, and Pete, I'm sure you agree, we recognize that spring training performances are noisy and not the best thing to make decisions on. So this is not I think there are a couple things that will come up in this episode. One is, this won't be us just being like, this guy is having a great spring, he's going to win MVP this year. We're going to try not to overreact to stuff. The other thing you're going to hear is probably us talking about guys who have done, either there's been talk of changes they've made, or there's been something going on that gives us reason to buy into this performance beyond just, hey, they're having a good spring, or on the opposite end, that they're having a bad spring. So we're just going to go through some guys, but Pete, any other thoughts on generally sort of what we're doing with this?
Yeah, spring training is, as an analyst, is one of those like damned if you do, damned if you don't things, because if you just say it's too small of a sample and spring training doesn't mean anything, well, there's no content, even though there's a lot of truth to that statement. If you say it does mean something, then everybody will rush down your throat to tell you it doesn't mean anything. So, I mean, you look for specific things like, is Edward Cabrera throwing more strikes? And if you can find things like that would indicate that maybe a player has a little bit of a change, then you should put some stock into spring training. If it's simple and it's like, hey, look, James Wood hit 3 home runs, so he's going to be MVP this year, then obviously you're kind of missing the forest for the trees there. So there are ways you can take stuff from spring training, but at the end of the day, yeah, it's a small sample and guys are just trying to get their feet wet, get their feet under them.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think people tend to go to extremes in both directions, and like, it isn't true that this has no meaning. It has limited meaning, and you have to be smart about how you analyze it. But guys did spend the offseason working on stuff, getting right, healthy, changing their approach, and like, it's worth looking at because this is our first signal. And I actually think in keeper leagues, this matters more than redraft to me. And the reason for that is buying in early or selling early when a guy has either made an improvement, like buying early when a guy makes an improvement, or selling early when a guy is falling off. It matters a little bit in redraft, but the reality is like redraft, like the upside of hitting on a guy like this is relatively small. It's this year, right? That's it. If you hit on a guy who breaks out in spring training and you're like, I believe in this guy, I'm going to buy in low and I'm going to jump early in a keeper league, you could be talking 3-4 years of value from that guy. Mm-hmm. So I do think there's a little bit more value in our world than in the average world. And this is it. It's our first signal of anything. So got to jump in and look. But
100%.
I think to get things started here, I'm going to talk about I'm going to throw a number at you. It's a super cherry pick number, but I do want to talk about this guy because he's had sort of an interesting spring. Through 2 starts and 5 innings pitched, Yoshinobu Yamamoto has a 9 ERA. That's the cherry pick number because his FIP is 2.62. XFIP, though, 3.93. But he's also walked 12.5% of hitters. Obviously, again, small sample. He's faced... Can I see how many batters he's faced? Yes, he's faced 24 hitters. So that's, you know, 12.5% of 24 is 3, right? Is that right? Is that 1/8 is 3?
I teach them.
You're a teacher, Pete. Come on.
Yeah, not math.
I'm pretty sure that's right. So.
Your lips to God's ears, brother.
Yes, 3. So if he had walked 2 hitters instead of 3, he'd be under 10%. If he walked 4 hitters instead of 3, we'd be like really worried. But from what you've seen from Yamamoto, do you have any concerns?
No, I think we got to kind of give him the benefit of the doubt here that he's working on stuff just like everybody else. There was some really shaky defense. You know, last episode you brought up Gavin Lux's defense. I'm pretty sure he had a mistake in there. I think there was a ball that Max Muncy just missed that ended up going for a double or a triple. This is all his most recent outing. I think the more concerning thing, and I use that word borderline facetiously because I'm still in on Yamamoto completely, is after the game, I can't think of who the player was, but basically said, you know, his stuff is great, but the pitch that hits the fastball. And the way that kind of came across is like, just wait at his fastball and you can hit this guy. I'm not sure if that's how it was intended to come across. You know, we've seen guys with middling velocity but elite command still be awesome fastball pitchers. And I think Yamamoto is going to fit into that bin nicely. So I don't take much from this at all. It just reminds us that spring training is spring training, and I mean, if you were in on Yamamoto before this, but now you're out, you're going to have such a long season, man. It is a six-month fantasy season. It is a grind. You can't give in to every poor performance.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. I think here are my... So I am, for the most part, cutting this concern because it was really just one bad spring training start, let alone two. But the thing that I am concerned about is the defense behind him is going to be bad, and especially the infield defense. And he's had good ground ball rates previously. He's at 57.1% for his ground ball rate in a small sample of spring training. I think he's going to be a high ground ball pitcher. And I think that is generally a good thing. I like guys who get lots of ground balls. Ground balls don't become home runs. That's a good thing. The challenge is this infield defense is going to be bad, I think. And not just like not great. Like it looks like it's going to be really bad. I don't think Muncy's really cutting it at third. They've already had to, they're now playing their you know, MVP caliber right fielder at short. I think that Betts should be a totally acceptable shortstop, but I don't think he's going to be great there. And Lux, they moved Lux to second base. He spiked a throw on a turning double play. Mm-hmm. So like whatever's going on with him is like there are real issues on this Dodger infield, and no, the Dodgers, like, I don't know, like that game that he started, everything went totally wrong. They had all those issues. They won 12-9. Now it's a spring training game, but like the Dodgers are good enough that could happen, and that's fine. Like they're gonna have, but the reality is for their starting rotation and for their bullpen, for that matter, that infield defense is going to matter. And they may win those games. Like they may have games where like the defense goes sideways and they give up 8 runs as a result. They might win that game 9-8, but they still gave up all those runs and it's still going to impact their pitching. And so I am a little concerned about the Dodgers from that perspective. I think that we've seen enough to have real concern about that, but that's kind of it with Yamamoto. I, the rest of this, you know, it, like you said, it's, we saw this, I don't know if you remember when Ohtani first came over and his first couple spring training starts, he looked terrible. And there people were already, and I was probably part of this, to be honest, were like, maybe he should only hit. It's really hard to do both. Maybe he can't do both. And then like, that worked out okay. It turns out Ohtani was fine despite a bad spring training. I suspect that's what we'll see with Yamamoto. But the two things I would sort of watch from this are like, is that walk rate, like that walk rate is a lot higher than it was expected. Is that just noise because he's only faced 24 hitters? Probably. But it's worth paying attention to if he's struggling with that going forward through spring. And then, of course, and then that defense. How much is that defense going to hurt him? Because he could very easily be the kind of guy who throws a like 3 FIP and a 3.8 ERA because those ground balls are getting through. So...
yeah, there's not much to analyze here with this, but we talked about over a year ago now the impact on defenses by banning the shift, and we specifically referenced Max Muncy, who I don't mean to pick on Muncy here, but he was hidden at second base, right? They were put the shift on, hide Max Muncy, get his powerful left-handed bat in the lineup. You can't hide him on defense anymore. You've got Mookie moving all over the place now, like you said. Gavin Lux looks like he has the yips. It's just, you're right, it's not a good defensive situation. I just question, I think, I just don't know how that impacts my rankings at all, right? Like, I don't think that moves Yamamoto up or down for me. Looking at where he's going, I'd feel pretty comfortable taking him there. Maybe based on ADP, the next pitcher to go after Yamamoto, right after him, is Tarik Skubal. I think I would already have Skubal ahead of Yamamoto. I don't know, maybe that's a controversial take, but much better park to pitch in, better defense behind him. I think I'd go with Skubal. Otherwise, I don't think that affects my rankings too much.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is I've been lower on Yamamoto than a lot of people have anyways, not because I think he's going to be bad, but just because I think there's a hype effect with the shiny new thing that people are jumping at and really excited about. And I think people just get overexcited about those shiny new things, and Yamamoto is definitely that. And so I've been a little lower than the market on him anyways, and I'm fine with that. And this just, you know, this is just another example of the kind of thing that could get in the way of him reaching the heights that the hype has set for him. So,
yeah.
All right, let's jump to another name. Pete, you got someone for me to react to?
I do. I've got a couple names. Start with another pitcher, just to keep that theme going. You know, a couple episodes I referenced Edward Cabrera as somebody who in keeper leagues I'm targeting late. His stuff is just so freaking ridiculous. And you brought up the concerns about control, which there are legit concerns about control. So far this spring, it's just 5 innings, which that's the last time I'm going to bring up how small the sample is. It's just you have to do it, right? It's just 5 innings. He has not given up a walk. Last year, he only threw 59% of his pitches for strikes, just 59%. That means that I could get a walk off Edward Cabrera. Some middle-aged guy who is not an athlete. I'd just stand there with the bat on my shoulders and, you know, every other time I'd get a walk. I'm only kidding. But this spring, he's throwing 70% of his pitches for strikes at 61 pitches. So yes, like I said, last time I promised bringing up the sample size, but that's the kind of stuff we're looking for. So I'm not sure this fits under like keeping or cutting that, because I don't think, you know what, I'm keeping it because it's a positive sign of the most concerning thing with Edward Cabrera. I'd also tack on, not that this has to do with his spring performance, that it looks like for sure he's going to have a spot in that rotation. They're a little beat up, and actually a lot of Marlins pitchers are pitching pretty well right now, but Edward Cabrera should have a spot in that rotation. So if he's throwing strikes, sky's the limit. And right now he is throwing strikes. 5 innings, no walks, 6 hits. He does only have 5 strikeouts, which is low for him, but whatever. He's so far this spring looking pretty good.
I do think like 5 innings is small. I was looking at his game log from last year. I think he only went once or twice during the entire season that he went 5 innings without a walk last year, which is crazy, but this is actual growth, I think. It looks like it. Like we said, you know, guys spend the off season working on stuff, right? Whatever it is they're working on. Like this guy goes to driveline to get more velocity, and this guy reworks his swing, and this guy does that, whatever. Like, I haven't heard that story with Edward Cabrera yet. I'm going to do a quick news search in case there is something out there that I missed. But it would make sense that Edward Cabrera spent his off season working on throwing strikes, right? That's what I would have done if I were him. And that's certainly what I would have told him if I were his hitting coach or his organization. So it does make sense that he would have been working on that. And that what we're seeing here isn't just random change in his performance, but the start of evidence that he's really turned a corner. Now, he's got to maintain that longer. I'm still a little dubious that Cabrera can maintain this level of command over an extended period of time. He's just been so far from being able to do that in his career. And I think, like, if he went from bad, like the command he had, to a walk rate that was above average, meaning better than average, right? Lower than average, but you know, lower than average in a good way. This is like when we talk about whether ADP is higher or lower.
Better.
It's, yeah. A better walk rate than average, like that would be I'm guessing, I should look. I think that would be probably a historic level of improvement. Like guys just don't improve that much that often. And so I think it is unlikely that Cabrera is going to have a low walk rate. However, I don't think he necessarily has to have a low walk rate. I think if Edward Cabrera can go from what he had, which was I'm walking like literally everybody and I have no command or control at all, to, you know, I don't know, like I at least fit in with the rest of the league. Like I'm bad, but I'm just normal bad instead of horrific bad, that might be enough because his stuff is good enough to make up for those walks. You think about guys like, you know, the guys, the names that come to mind for me are like Dylan Cease, Blake Snell. And I think that's the right upside to look at with a guy like Cabrera, which I think is telling in a couple of ways. One is we've seen what Cease and Snell can be at their absolute best, and it's elite. They can be among the very best pitchers in baseball when they are literally at their best, right? They are also inconsistent, and they're not guys that you can regularly rely on doing the same thing year after year after year. For Snell, that's been both injury and the ability to stay in games and walks and innings. For Cease, it's mostly been the ability to like keep his pitch counts reasonable. But like, you know, we've talked about this with Dylan Cease's trade value this offseason, that like it's the White Sox are like, we have this ace that we want to trade. And other teams seem to be like, yeah, you got a guy who can be an ace sometimes. He's a good pitcher, but he's not really an ace. And I think that's sort of the path that Edward Cabrera could be on. And that's the upside I see for Cabrera, is like, he's a guy who I think could throw a truly elite season at some point, but year to year, you're always going to be wondering, is this the year that the control really bottoms out? Is this the year that he, you know, things don't really work for him and he has sort of middling results instead of great results? And I think that's just going to be the story of his career. But I'm keeping this performance. I think it's really interesting. I think it's showing that he has the ability to do something that we need to see him do. And so, yeah, I think Edward Cabrera, like, he's not moving up to like, you know, I'm not like, oh, he's a top 40 pitcher now or something like that. But like, he's moving up into my, among that list of guys that you might grab late in a draft because they're interesting and you see some upside there. He's moved up in that group.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm totally in on the talent, like I said. I get the year-to-year thing for sure. If folks are curious about my talent take on it, just go back to episode 122, and you can see the time notes there where we talked about Edward Cabrera as opposed to, you know, diving into the whole thing again so soon. I do wonder, like, if it is a simple change, it's throwing one pitch less or as a result, another pitch more that he's capable of throwing for strikes, then I could see it actually being more of a long-term shift. He is still just 25. He'll turn 26 in a couple of months. It's a deep arsenal. So when guys have arsenals that deep, sometimes it can be just a simple tweak that leads to a big shift in those whip numbers and those walk numbers. So we'll see with Cabrera. I think there's a lot left to be determined for Cabrera, but this year is going to be a big one.
Yeah, that makes sense. So let's go to a hitter, and this is a guy who I think we can be pretty quick about because I know you've historically liked this guy, and it felt a little bit like coming into this season, he had, you'd gotten over him. It'd been just too much, and part of that is that Eloy Jimenez, in addition to missing time again last year, he just wasn't that good last year. He got into 120 games. He got 489 plate appearances. It was just a 105 WRC plus. He had 18 home runs those 120 games, which is still pretty good power. But the overall performance was just sort of okay. He, in 29 plate appearances this spring, has a 255 WRC plus. He has a 536, 552, 750 triple slash. That's pretty good, but he's got a home run. He's got 10 RBIs in 10 games. That's pretty good as well. He also seems to be extremely aggressive out there in spring. He has a 3.4% walk rate and a 6.9% strikeout rate. The guy's just putting the ball in play left and right. Are you pushing him back up your draft board? Are you like trying to buy him now? Is this like, we know what the talent is and he's still just 27. What do you think about Eloy Jimenez?
Yeah, he's a great example of how no matter how you feel about a particular player, everybody has their price, because I have Eloy in a ton of leagues already this season. And I've still yet to draft most of my, if not all of my ESPN leagues, where he's also ranked quite low. And I anticipate getting him in quite a few of them. Obviously the util only hurts, but if you wait that long to fill that spot, you can fill it with somebody who could potentially have a pretty big season. Now, the lineup around him is atrocious, especially if Luis Robert can't stay on the field. But just looking at Eloy himself, I mean, yeah, you said he's putting all those balls in play in spring training. I'm not surprised he cut his strikeout rate last year to being sub 20%, down at 19%. So despite it kind of being a weird season for him and once again an injury plagued season, although did he have an appendectomy last season? Like, at some point you've got to give guys the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, whatever at that point. When he was healthy, he did seem to have a little bit of a launch angle issue that would be below his career average. So assuming he can bring that up a little bit, maybe even just to that 8.4 degree level it was at back in 2021. I don't know. I could see everything kind of coming together for Eloy. Like you said, he is just 27 years old, all the talent in the world. So I'm not out. I'll keep this spring performance, but even before the spring performance, I was drafting him. So if anything, it's a little bit of confirmation bias.
Yeah, I think that's probably true for me too. I was already a fan, but I do think, you know, anytime you see these injured players, these guys with history of injury, and their performance starts to drop, you start to wonder how much, like, has the physical toll just caught up with them to the point that the upside is just not there anymore? And seeing Eloy just destroy spring pitching is a good reminder that the upside may still be there for him. And if that is there, he becomes a really interesting target. I think he went for, in our podcasters league draft auction that we had last week, we did a live stream of that. It was pretty fun. Hopefully you guys caught it. If you didn't, it should be up on YouTube. If it's not, I'll make sure it is. Good conversation with a handful of other podcasters out there. But in that, Eloy went for $10, and I was sort of in the middle of doing my stream thing and didn't get to bid 11, and I wish I had, because I think he's really intriguing this year. You know, we know what the upside is. He is capable of putting up a huge season if he can just stay on the field. And so I'm excited, and I'm glad to see him out there looking healthy and looking like his old self, even in a small spring sample. So let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep going through some spring performances, and we'll tell you if we're going to keep them or cut them. All right, welcome back. Pete, we've talked about a couple pitchers, a hitter. Who do you got for us next?
This particular player is a longtime favorite of keeper cut. Going into the 2021 season, I remember both you and I had this person in our top 10 first baseman in keeper leagues. And like, we actually got some like Twitter feedback. It was like, how can you possibly have Paul Goldschmidt as a top 10 first baseman? I have him like 15th or something. And then Goldie put forward back-to-back seasons of basically being like a National League MVP candidate. He was awesome for those two seasons. But I started to get concerns last year, as did most people, because it really wasn't a great season. You didn't get your money's worth. And yet he's still going as a top 75 pick on NFBC. I'm filtering for, you know, back in November drafts, for crying out loud. So I'm sure if you did it more recently, he's down a little bit more. I know he went later in a couple of my drafts on there. But the point you made is he's a top 100 player. And the biggest spike in concern, I guess, I had for Goldschmidt last season was that we saw this increase in strikeout rate. He went from, in 2020, 18, granted shortened season, 18.6% strikeout rate, and that has steadily climbed each season. And last year, he had a 23.4% strikeout rate, his worst since 2018. So far this spring, which again, this is a tiny sample size, but he is already posting a 40% strikeout rate. He's struck out five times, I believe, five times in 20 plate appearances or something. I just had it up. I couldn't see it. But I know his strikeout rate is around 40%. Is that a major concern? You know, pitchers maybe being a little bit ahead of hitters, whatever. Goldschmidt is as much of a veteran as you'll find in the major league, so he's probably just kind of going through the motions. But it's not exactly a promising sign for a guy who has had an uptick in strikeouts each of the last four seasons and who disappointed us last year. And the cherry on top, of course, being his age. Paul Goldschmidt is now entering his age 36 season. I don't know. He might turn 37 during the season. I have no idea. So there's a lot of red flags all of a sudden emerging for Goldschmidt, not to mention the lineup around him. He's going to have Brendan Donovan in front of him and Nolan Gorman's 30% strikeout rate behind him, according to Roster Resource. Like, all of a sudden, all of these things are coming into play, and I'm not in on Goldschmidt this season.
Interesting. I do think the spring performance for him is a little concerning, and it's not just the strikeout rate. He also, so we were talking about Eloy a moment ago and how he's like, he's not walking or striking out. He's just hammering everything. Goldie has gotten, he's always been a passive hitter. He's always been very selective. Like that's been part of Paul Goldschmidt's charm, but he has 20 plate appearances so far in spring training. And if I'm looking correctly, 12 of those 20 have ended in a walk or a strikeout. It's 8 strikeouts and 4 walks. So he sort of crossed over in 20 plate appearances to being just like way too passive. The strikeout rate, you mentioned last year, the 23.4% strikeout rate, that was even higher after the very start of the season. So early on, he had a relatively low strikeout rate through like April, basically. And if you look at his strikeout rate from the start of May through the end of the season, it's 25.7%. So there's definitely like, there is this sense of decline with Paul Goldschmidt that he said, we're looking at, you know, multiple years of strikeout rate increase that actually continued through the season last season. It's not just that the season as itself was bad. It was getting worse from a strikeout rate perspective. And he does turn 37 in season, not until September, but the end is going to come soon for Paul Goldschmidt, right? This isn't a guy who's going to be around forever. I'm definitely moving him down because I think there's risk. I think the performance this spring increases my concern about that risk a small amount. And there are just too many other options at first base. And I think we saw this play out to an extreme in that podcaster's auction where he got nominated by Sarah Sanchez and nobody bid. Now, I don't think nobody bid because everyone's like, he's a $1 guy. I don't want him. But it was one of those things where I think everybody, like, there's this sense sometimes when a guy gets nominated. I do this a lot where I'm like, I don't know. It's hard to pay attention to every player that's nominated. And so sometimes a guy gets nominated and I'm like, I don't need a first baseman. I'm not really excited about this guy. He's going to get bid up anyways. And so I like take that moment to go like, look at my sheet. Who do I want to nominate next? Who am I, like, adjust some of my values if there's positions getting thin, stuff like that. And I think it was a moment where literally all 11 other teams were like, oh, someone will bid on Paul Goldschmidt, but I don't really care if I win him. And that resulted in him going for $1, which is just crazy. Do not take this to be like, oh, Paul Goldschmidt, striking out 40% of the time in spring training, $1 player. That's it. That's not what we're saying. But I do think it's telling that in a league of you know, podcasters, analysts, experts, whatever you want to call them, everybody was like, I'm willing to look the other way right now. And everyone came back and then was like, whoa, what just happened here? Why did he only go for a buck? But it was literally that everyone was like, I'm not that excited about him. And I think that's a fair assessment of Paul Goldschmidt right now.
Yeah, and if folks are like, all right, it's, you know what, they're making mountains out of molehills again, spring training, whatnot. This is a trend. This is a trend that is being reinforced by what we're seeing in the spring. We're not just looking at, oh, 40% strikeout rate. We must have alarm bells about Paul Goldschmidt. I mean, look, he swung more in the zone last year, but made less contact in the zone on average. It was his lowest zone contact rate of his career, by the way, at 76.8, which is well below the major league average. He was chasing more. I mean, it was not a pretty picture, whiffing more, worst whiff rate of his career. There's concerns here with Paul Goldschmidt at the plate. So, again, this isn't just a spring thing, but spring is not making us feel any better.
Yeah. So let's take a look at another hitter. I'm going to go back to the outfield, and we're going to talk about a guy who we have talked about fairly recently, I think, but Andy Páez, I'm pretty sure it's how it's pronounced. I said that last time we talked about him too, but Andy Páez is destroying spring. He on the Fangraphs spring training leaderboard, which I think sets a minimum of, it looks like 16 plate appearances. He is your spring training leader in WOBA at 6.45. It's 21 plate appearances, but 9.5% walk rate, 23.8% strikeout rate. He's just killing the ball. And, you know, we were talking earlier this episode about the Dodgers' issues on the infield, though he is not an infielder. And so he can't, well, should say that. Maybe he could play third base. Who knows what the Dodgers might decide to try to do. But there are some question marks, I would say, across their lineup. I mean, obviously, like, This is the second time we've talked negatively about the Dodgers. The Dodgers are really good. They're probably going to win the West. They're probably going to, you know, be contenders for the NL. Like, they're a very good team. But James Outman had strikeout issues last year and is sort of unproven. Their right field right now is a Jason Hayward platoon with either Chris Taylor or Kike Hernandez or both of them. I'm not really sure. Paez is a righty, so he could platoon with Hayward. I don't think he necessarily needs to platoon with Hayward. I think he could supplant that platoon at some point. And like I said, he's having just a great spring. So, Pete, are you keeping or cutting this spring performance from Andy Paez? Is he moving up your ranks?
I think you have to put him on your radar because of how he's performing this spring. And this isn't like a prospect that we had never heard of before, all of a sudden tearing up spring training. It's somebody who had a little bit of a reputation, like you said, and now looks like it's things are coming together. You know, is he going to find time with the Dodgers or not? I think no matter what, I think he's going to find his way into a lineup because the Dodgers are either going to play him because they need him, or they're a team that's winning right now. They have a piece that is gaining a lot of, maybe gaining a lot of trade value based on this spring training, and they'll find a way to move him. But no, I mean, there's nothing to really critique. The dude's WRC plus in the spring is over 300. So there's nothing for me to really say like, well, have we looked at this? He's tearing it up this spring. Will a job be there? I don't know. If it is, he's absolutely worth picking up. And I've noticed in quite a few of the auctions I've done, and even in through waivers, and I think it was the pitcher list Ott New League, he went for a dollar. If you can use one of your 40 roster spots in Ott New and a $1 Andy Paez, then go and do it. There's no risk there, and there's potential massive reward for stashing him.
Yeah, and I think the other thing with him is, like, if you go back and look at his historical performances, really dating back to when he got into, so, you know, he was in rookie league in 2018, 2019. He was not part of the player pool for 2020 because he was so young, which makes sense. But so if you really just go back to 2021, he's a 20-year-old hitting in high, like reaching high A. And Andy Paez had a 14% walk rate, 24.5% strikeout rate. He went up to double A the next year and the walk rate went down a little bit, but he basically maintained the strikeout rate. He went up. He was again in double A last year. Now, last year he had a shoulder injury. He missed a bunch of time. Didn't play as much. Only had 142 plate appearances, but 17.6% walk rate, 22.5% strikeout rate. And all three of those stops, he had ISOs over 200. So he's controlling the zone. The strikeouts aren't a concern. The walk rate looks good. He's hitting for power. Like, all the things that you want from a hitter, especially in an Ott New League or a league that's more based on just sort of pure offensive prowess rather than 5x5. But even in 5x5, he stole 7 bases last year. He stole 6 the year before. Last year, that 7 bases, like I said, that was in 33 games, 142 plate appearances. He's not a burner by any means, but could he chip in 10, 15 steals? Maybe. I think, you know, 10 is probably a better bet. The projections all have him for anywhere from 0 to 5. And so the projections are not expecting any speed from him. But like I said, he stole 7 last year. So there's a good chance he's not a 0 there. And while the Dodgers don't seem like a run wild kind of team, look at what Freddie Freeman did last year. Like, they seem to be comfortable with good base stealers who aren't particularly fast taking their chances when they know what to do. And I think Paez could fit into that camp. He did get caught 3 times last year, so maybe I'm making too much of it. But
yeah, he's been caught, I think he is, 22 times in 58 attempts.
Over his minor league career?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not very good. It was 7 out of 10 isn't too bad.
But hey, he's trying. I don't know. He don't care.
Yeah.
He's going for it anyway. Well, I guess we don't care. It doesn't hurt us if they get caught. It just helps us if they get him.
maybe I'm overstating it, so we'll see. But I think regardless of that, he seems like we could see a good overall offensive profile, good power, good on base. The batting average might not be great, but I don't know. If he doesn't strike out too much, he's got a chance to put the ball in play a good amount and turn that into something. So yeah, Paez is a guy who late in drafts, those like 40 man rosters in Ott New really make more sense. In smaller rosters, he's a wait and see, but he's on my watch list because the second I hear a report that he may be up, that there's a chance he breaks camp with the team, that he might win that right field job, like any like inkling that that's happening, and Paez becomes a guy I'm really interested in. Pete, who do you have for us next?
Yeah, so this next guy is Francisco Alvarez, catcher for the New York Mets. I was hoping there would be more of a discount in drafts, and I was looking at the NFBC ADP, and I was like, all right, maybe he's inflated here because the majority of them are two catcher leagues, but he's pretty consistently going around basically like pick 160 across places. If you look at Fantasy Pros, and anywhere from 140 on NFBC up to 178 on ESPN. So he's got a pretty small range there. I wish there was more of a discount, but this is a former top prospect in Francisco Alvarez with the bat. And now when prospects get called up, particularly catchers, it can take them a long time to adjust because they're not just focusing on hitting. And Alvarez did have a few plate appearances at DH for sure, but I mean, they want him to be a catcher. He's been catching. And obviously that has maybe taken a toll on his hitting. Last year, I wish I could say he got better in the second half as he began to get, you know, used to the MLB grind. He really didn't. His second half batting average, if we just want to look at average, was 174. And it doesn't get much better when you dive deeper into the numbers. His second half WRC plus was 72, whereas in the first half was 119. So last season was a little bit of a slog for him, although he hit a quiet like 26 homers. This spring, though, Francisco Alvarez is
25. Here. Don't overstate it. He'll be at 25.
25. But he already has three this spring in just 14 at-bats, 18 total plate appearances. He's got three homers. So he's just a guy who no one's out on, clearly, based on the ADP, right? I mean, he had a pretty mediocre offensive season last year, despite, you know, obviously more power than your average catcher, and he's still going as basically a top 150 pick. So this isn't like some steal, but this is a player with like number one catcher upside who is showing that upside in the spring, has a full season under his belt, is now just going to be deployed. I mean, last year, I can't remember who the Mets brought in, and there was some sort of questions about, like, you know, how much playing time is Alvarez going to get, at least early on. He is just the Mets' everyday player now. So Alvarez is going to sneaky hit for sure, not even sneaky, probably come close to 30 homers. And if he continues what he's doing in the spring, he's going to be a steal, even at that slightly inflated ADP that I think he's currently at.
Yeah, I think I'm keeping your analysis on how good he is going to be or could be. I think the question I have is like looking at that ADP list. So here's the catcher ADP list. And I'm gonna put a dividing line in here because I think there's a pretty clear divide here after number 9. 1 through 9 are Adley Rutschman, Will Smith, JT Realmuto, William Contreras, Yiner Diaz, who I think we should talk about in a moment, Salvador Perez, Cal Raleigh, Sean Murphy, and Wilson Contreras. And I put the dividing line in there because those 9 are, to me, established, proven, reliable catchers, with the exception of Yiner Diaz, who seems like a little bit of an outlier being as high up as he is. He's had that he had a good year, but he's still sort of in the, to me, more of a like, yeah, you know, he did it for a year. Let's see what he can do when he actually has a full-time job camp. Then you get into starting at number 10 for catchers, Francisco Alvarez, Gabby Moreno, Keibert Ruiz, Jonah Heim, Logan Ohapi, Mitch Garver, Bo Naylor, Tyler Stevenson, Alejandro Kirk, which is, and it goes on from there, but you're getting into a combination of young upside, have shown the talent, but haven't really done it for a season yet, or older guys like Garver, who we know what they're capable of, but there's other warts and concerns there. I look at that and I see that clear dividing line. And I guess the question I have in terms of like, as good as Alvarez has been this spring, is it enough for you to push him up above those proven established guys? Or is he still just sort of the top choice of the unproven guys right now?
I don't know. It's a weird argument because, you know, like you said, Yiner Diaz, based on that like half season, is a top 5 catcher right now. So to me, I think you could easily make the case that you can take Francisco Alvarez 5th, and I think you could defend it. All those guys have warts. I'll be honest, Wilson Contreras, seeing him ahead of Francisco Alvarez in ADP on every place except Yahoo is just a little weird to me. I'd much rather take Francisco Alvarez. He's much younger. Wilson Contreras is going to be turning 32 I'm not a big believer in the Cardinals. I don't mean to make this about Wilson Contreras, but like, sure, he's proven for whatever that's worth, right? Is 20 homers and however many RBI and a 264 average. If that's playing it safe at catcher, you want to take a catcher that high, that's fine. I think I look at this more of, if I'm going to take a catcher in the top 150, I want the upside of Alvarez as opposed to the whatever Wilson Contreras' floor is, which I don't think is that great. I think we saw Sean Murphy's floor last year, where in the first half of the season, we were viewing him as like a top 50 pick. And then he was so awful in the second half that he's not even mentioned as a top five catcher anymore. And then you got guys with warts, right? Like Cal Raleigh, sure, he's going to hit you 30 homers. At what cost to your average? I think you can easily make the case, without even mentioning this spring, that you would prefer the upside of Francisco Alvarez as the fifth or sixth catcher off the board. I think that's fine.
Yeah, I think so. Here's my take on this. I think this is one of those cases we've talked a lot. We haven't done position rankings this year. In the past, when we've done position rankings, one of the things that's become very obvious is that at the top of the position rankings, like, I don't vary a ton from redraft because I want to win this year. And in general, guys who are good this year are going to be good next year. And like, I don't push stuff around a lot. But as you get into the back half of the top 10, outside the top 10 in a position, is where things start to move around. And I think that if I'm in a redraft league, Wilson Contreras, first of all, he had an incredible second half last year. There's some talk that he could be DHing a good chunk of the time, which could push him from like 120 games to 140, 150 games, which I think makes a big difference. And all of that stuff, plus him being a safer bet, outshines the upside for Alvarez, I think, in redraft. But in our world, in these keeper leagues, that changes things for me in this case, because I think the upside of, if you take Alvarez as even the sixth, seventh, eighth catcher off the board, and he hits what his upside is, you're talking about having a, you know, a guy who's contending with Rutschman and Smith, probably more Smith-like than Rutschman-like, but in that category of catcher at a really low price for the foreseeable future. And that's really valuable. And so I think that does push him up a bit. I do agree with you, by the way. I think like the catcher rankings are just weird. I think like, if I look at this ADP ranking of Rutschman, Smith, Real Muto, Contreras, Diaz, like I think Alvarez versus Diaz is an interesting debate. I would absolutely take Alvarez over Salvador Perez. I think that's an easy choice for me. I think I would take him over Wilson Contreras. I'd probably take him over Cal Raleigh. I think Sean Murphy is too low in this ADP list. So like, it's a weird list anyways. But I think the answer for me is like, I do think in keeper leagues, he should be going ahead of some of these quote unquote established guys. He's not just the top of the unestablished tier. He's more interesting, has more long-term upside, and can do more for your team than some of the guys going ahead of him. So
yeah, I think obviously we're talking keeper league. So yes, 100%. I kept Francisco Alvarez for like a 14th round pick or something in the listener league. So I'm with you lockstep on that. I just look at some of these catchers, and it takes me back to even in redraft, like if I'm going to take a catcher this high, I need more upside. Like you brought up that Wilson Contreras might DH. Okay. But 140 games, he's never done that in his career. He's been over 500 plate appearances once. Like, yeah, because he was catching, maybe he DHs now at the age of 32 and it's different. But over the last three seasons, we're talking about like an average of 60 runs, an average of 60 RBI, an average of 21 homers, and a sub 250 batting average. Like if I have to take a catcher at that point in the draft, and that's what I'm getting, I'd rather the guy with the upside. I think it's just an approach difference.
Yeah, makes sense. So let's take a quick break. We come back, we're gonna have only a little bit of time left. So I'm gonna switch to sort of a lightning round, go through some more names quickly. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back. As I promised before the break, we're gonna try to get through a handful more names in the next 10 minutes. And so we're going to shift things a little bit. I'm going to rattle off some quick numbers for you just to get some reactions, Pete. We're going to start with this. Through the first, you know, week or two of spring training, here are your top five in FIP. And this is, I think, again, I'm using the Fangraphs leaderboard. It looks like it's about 6.2 innings is the minimum. So guys over 6 2/3 innings, all these guys have 8 innings or 9. The top five in FIP are JP Sears, AJ Puck, Spencer Strider, Cutter Crawford, Tyler McGill. Now, one of these guys is not like the others. I'm assuming you are going to keep the strong performance from Spencer Strider. He was number one on my pitcher list. He's going to stay there. He's good.
Yeah, he's okay, too. I was going to say Cutter Crawford, but Strider, fine.
Fine, yeah. But the others, Sears, Puck, Crawford, McGill. Which of those guys are you like, yes, I am in? And which of them are you like, you know, maybe you're more tepid on it. Maybe you're just like, nah, this is noise. But like, what are your reactions to those four?
Yeah, I'm going to shoot straight with my list with our listeners. JP Sears, I'm limited on. Don't know enough there. AJ Puck, I love. And it's not just because he's been utterly dominant this spring. I've always been in on AJ Puck. I brought up last year how, you know, he's before they got, or maybe this was 2 years ago, that like I wouldn't be out on AJ Puck for a dollar or not, new lease, because I think he's going to end up the close. He's just too good. The stuff is too good. And now that Miami's like, you know what, let's try him as a starter again. In spring training, it looks like that has been a great decision. This was a guy with absolutely elite pedigree coming out of Florida. I really, really like AJ Puck. He's had to deal with injuries. It looks like everything's straightening out. I'd say it's a lock he's in the rotation at this point. I mean, I thought I read that Miami has him penciled in as like their number three starter right now, which is a little surprising given the depth they've had over the years. So Puck, all in on. Crawford, a little bit older than people might think, but he certainly raised eyebrows last year. He's kind of like an analyst favorite pick right now as a sleeper. But if we all think he's a sleeper, I don't know if that actually makes him a sleeper. But he has been really good this spring for the Sox. It's nice that they've taken one of these guys, these Houks, Whitlocks, Crawfords, and just said, you are a starter or you are a reliever. It would be nice if they would do that more definitively with their players. And it seems like they have done that with Cutter Crawford, who is basically the ace now. So God bless. And the last name there, remind me, who was the last name there?
Tyler McGill.
Yeah, McGill. So I'm tired of being tricked by McGill. I know the velocity's up and whatnot, but it seems like he's had stretches in the past of like the strikeouts are there, going deep in outings, looking good. Everybody got on board. And then there was either an injury or a slew of bad performances that tuned us out. I mean, look, he's going to make that Mets rotation, right? They're a mess. So you're going to get innings potentially. I have, you know, to own up to it, I have drafted him in a few NFBC 50s just because he was available so late. You know, why not? I think I got him in TGFBI as well and maybe got him in the Podcasters League. So I guess I technically am in on Tyler McGill, but be hesitant, folks, because we've fallen for this before at least two other times where, oh, man, McGill breaking out. He looks awesome. Ty Lord. And then he just didn't. So there's a reason he's going as late as he's going.
Yeah, and I think the question with him is just like how much of injury has been a factor and is he finally healthy? And that is an interesting, I think, question. I won't go any deeper on any of those guys. I think your points are mostly spot on. I'll make a couple of quick comments. Cutter Crawford, I think I'd like to see more strikeouts even in the spring. Like that's my big concern with him is can he keep up the strikeouts as a starter? And he hasn't done that. And so I think that's worth watching, but I am in on him still. JP Sears, just because you didn't really talk a lot about him, the thing that stands out to me for Sears is if you go back to 2021, another guy who didn't do anything in 2021. Now he is 25 years old at this point and in AA, which I think is an important note to make. But from 2021 through, you know, the present day, he has been at a 30% or above, 1 year it was 29.4%, I'm going to count it, 30% or above strikeout rate at every minor league stop. Now, some of that was in relief, some of it's starting, it's in or out, whatever. But he had good, interesting, impressive strikeout numbers everywhere. Then he's gotten to the majors, he got to the majors first with the Yankees and then with Oakland, and the strikeout rates have been bad. In 2022, his strikeout rate, 17.7%, 6.56 K per nine. Last year, 21.9%, good improvement, 8.41 strikeout per nine, good improvement, but still not very good. The thing I'm excited about with him is the 41.4% strikeout rate, 13.5 strikeouts per nine. Yeah, again, it's only eight innings, but if he can show that kind of strikeout stuff, and we know he's got it in his repertoire because he showed it to us in the minors. That's really interesting. And so that's where I see some breakout potential. But it is worth noting, as you mentioned with Crawford, Crawford will turn 28 right around opening day. JP Sears turned 28 a little less than a month ago. So these guys are not, this isn't a you know, a 24, 25-year-old you're looking for a breakout from. I think that's a good reason on both these guys to temper expectations a bit, but they're both interesting to me. So let me throw another number at you. And this is a guy who we have talked about before. There's one number for him, though, that is particularly interesting to me. Byron Buxton says he's healthy, says he can run, says he's ready to go. And the number that stands out for me is in 14 plate appearances, he has two triples. And the reason that stands out to me is, like, we've seen him hit for power. We know he can hit for power. He does have a home run as well. Like, in general, like, his spring numbers look good. He's got the strikeout rate down. That's great. It's only 14 plate appearances. You can't fake a triple. And I guess maybe that's not true. Maybe, you know, the ball bounced around and he, like, jogged his way around. But, like, in general, to get a triple, you got to run. So maybe I should go back and watch these triples and make sure he didn't fake his way into them. But, like, if you're looking for signs of health from Byron Buxton, two triples is actually an interesting number to me in terms of what it says about his ability at this precise moment to play at his peak. Now, how long he can stay healthy, whole different question, but what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, look, you're right. I mean, to get a major league triple, I mean, you've got to display a certain amount of athleticism. Not that sprint speed correlates perfectly to getting a triple, but he was 94th percentile in sprint speed last season and still only gave us 304 at-bats. So, I mean, Byron Buxton, you know, we talked about him either last week or the week before. If he is actually healthy, especially based on his ADP, actually entirely based on his ADP, because I don't trust him to stay healthy, you go and get him. Especially if it's like a, you know, a head-to-head league where, you know, he's just going to win you weeks as long as he's healthy. And then, you know, when he gets hurt and is thrown in the 60-day IL, God forbid, but it's happened in the past, you cut him and you move on at the price you got him at. That's not going to hurt so bad. I just, you know, he looks great this spring, and you're right, he's saying the right things. And two triples is definitely worth acknowledging from an athleticism perspective. But, you know, it's just some of us are going to take that risk. Some of us are not. It could work out, might not. It's just at this point, I don't think there's too much left to say about Buxton. Just stay in the field, man.
Yeah, that's about it. And I think we've talked about him before that, like, it's his ADP that has dropped far enough to make him a justifiable pickup, and that's where I'm interested in him. So I also got him in the Podcasters League, but I don't remember how much I paid for him, but it wasn't very much because it was just like, yep, his price is low enough now that I'm in. Another name to throw at you, because we got about a minute or two left. Matt Manning, there's been hype about Manning for years. He was a top prospect, then he was not very good with the Tigers. He was okay with the Tigers in 2022. He was again not good last year. And there's been a lot of talk about him this spring because the stuff plus looks good. The strikeouts are way up. The walks are a little up, but they're fine. Like, a lot of stuff looks good. He's also given up 4 home runs in 8 innings.
Right.
Are you 4 home runs in a spring training park, you know, whatever. I'm really excited about the rest of this. Are you like, look, dude, if you're still giving up, like, I'm glad you're striking everybody out, but if the other guys are all taking you deep, it's not going to work.
Yeah. I mean, look, like you said, the pedigree's there. He just turned 26 years old, so it wouldn't be the most unheard of thing to see a real pitcher emerge here who's fantasy relevant. You know, I don't think anyone will question the stuff. Obviously, it looks good this spring. Obviously, it looked good as he was coming up through the minor leagues. The 4 homers, I mean, it's hard not to raise an eyebrow at 4 homers in 8 innings, even if it is the spring. At the same time, when the season finally kicks off, he gets to call Comerica home. And that is not a park that is conducive to a lot of home runs. So that can actually work in his favor. If a lot of balls are just hitting the air and they're not going over the fence, that's usually a pretty good thing for pitchers. Combine that with strikeouts, that's kind of that could be a potentially lethal arm. It's just, you know, you really have to temper your expectations. A career high of 85 innings pitched, he hasn't done that since 2021. So even if everything kind of goes right here, if he keeps the walks down, he keeps the ball in the park, he's getting swings and misses, going maybe a little bit deep into outings. At some point, he is going to be capped. So it's all about, you know, building your draft strategically. At the same time, I can't imagine he costs anything in most drafts, especially 12 teamers, which I bet most of our listeners play in. He goes undrafted. So maybe you just don't care about the innings pitch total and you want to take a shot late in drafts. I have guys I prefer to take shots on over Matt Manning, but if he's one of your guys, I think that totally makes sense and is completely fair.
Yeah, the one comment I will make is those home runs. Like, one of them was Henry Davis, who may be a breakout player here. I think he's an interesting guy. Cannon Smith and Jigba and Jake Lamb hit the others. Lamb is at least sort of an established, these were just yesterday, three of the four were yesterday, and so that's why I'm mentioning those. Lamb is at least sort of an established hitter, kind of, but those aren't guys that, like, especially, you know, Smith and Jigba and Lamb are not guys that you're like, oh, well, like, you know, Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton took him deep. That's not on him. These are not guys you really want hammering the ball off you. On the other hand, the expected batting average on Smith and Jigba's home run was 120. It would have been a home run in 4 out of 30 parks, according to StatCast. And the expected batting average of the Lamb home run was 210, and it would have been a home run in 0 out of 30 parks, according to StatCast. The Davis home run was legit.
Sure.
So, but the others, so there is a part of me that's like, okay, he gave up two home runs to guys you really don't want to see him giving home runs to, but they were cheapies, man. And so I'm willing to give him a little bit of a pass on those. And this is where I think those small samples in spring training can sometimes fool you, because it's like, dude, he gave up 4 home runs in 8 innings. Yeah, but two of them weren't really home runs. Two of them were flyouts that happened to get out of the park. And so over the course of a season, maybe that's not super concerning. And so I am watching Manning. To me, he's a guy you draft more as a prospect than as a part of your rotation, though, because you just can't rely on him. So Anyways, with that, we've been going for an hour. We've covered a lot of names. It's a lot of words spilled on spring training stats, but I don't know. I enjoyed it. Hopefully it was useful to you. Yeah, got to do it at some point, right? And honestly, like, we're going to record again next week, and we're still sort of holding it, have spring training stats to respond to. So
60 plate appearances instead of 40. Yeah. So watch out for next week.
Yeah, there we go. Anyways, hope you enjoyed listening, and we'll be back with you next week.